Here's the rest of our crowd coming in. Very good. Everybody's found us. Very good.
Hey, everyone. This is Heart of a Heartless World, a podcast cultivating substance and resisting the toxic effects of capitalism.
Perfect timing. We're just like this is good timing. Hello. Welcome. Welcome.
And we have a special episode for you. My local DSA comrade and longtime minister, Andrew Guthrie, joined me in Terre Haute for a tour of the Eugene V. Debs Museum.
Hopefully we're enjoying. Everybody feeling good so far? Good. Glad to hear.
Afterward, we sat down with museum director Allison Dirk to discuss Debs, faith, organizing, and resources for hope. We hope you enjoy.
Actually spent most of his life within a few blocks of this house as far as his residence.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Heart of a Heartless World, and we are here today with Allison Dirk, the director of the Eugene V. Debs Museum in Terre Haute, Indiana. It's great to have you on the podcast, Allison. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks for being at the Debs house today.
Yeah, and we're actually up in the top floor, which has this amazing mural.
And the murals that you see now are about 45 years old.
I could say something about that. This mural is amazing.
Yeah, so the attic or the third floor of the house, the vaulted walls are covered in over 160 linear feet, I have read, of beautiful acrylic murals by a late local artist named John Laska. They wrap around the room in a chronological journey through the life, times, and then legacy of Gene Debs. They're overwhelming, honestly. It's hard to describe like without visuals to go along with it, but they're stunning. They wrap around the room and just give an amazing teaching tool and resource, usually to cap off our tours and get the bird's eye view of Debs' life and work.
So let's start there. Who is Eugene V. Debs? I'm a Hoosier, which I learned today is actually maybe a bit of a swear word if you're from St. Louis. I'm a Hoosier. My friend Andrew here is a Hoosier.
Adopted.
Yes. Currently resides in Indiana. So we are familiar with Debs, but who is Debs? Why is he an important figure in the history of the workers' movement and the history of democracy, of the fabric of American life, as well as one of the most well-known socialists in the United States?
Definitely. So Debs was one of the most important Hoosiers, I would argue, who ever lived, most consequential. I think anybody who's ever worked for a living has benefited from the movement that Debs was a part of. One of the most important labor organizers and figures in the history of this country, led one of the biggest strikes in this country's history as well, the Pullman strike of 1894, became a socialist in part because of those events, ran for president 5 times on the socialist ticket from 1900 to 1920, at its peak in 1912, earning about 1 million votes, 6% of the vote that year. And then the last time Debs ran for president was from the most unique campaign headquarters, and that was a prison cell in Atlanta after Debs had illegally spoken out against World War I, when you simply could not do that. Said that it was always the ruling class declaring the wars, the working class fighting the battles, ended up with a 10-year sentence for having the gall to say such a thing, ran for president one last time from his prison cell in 1920, earning almost 1 million votes, 3.5% of the vote that year, spent his last years in and around Terre Haute continuing to be part of the fight to build a better world. But like I said, I don't think there's a person alive who works, you know, who has not benefited from the movement Debs was a part of, not just him as an individual singular figure, but as just one part of a movement that shaped all of our lives in some way.
And if you know Terre Haute history, prominent red light district because we're a transportation hub. And Debs found it immoral to punish these women for trying to make a living while the men...
It's amazing. And speaking of convict 9653, I want to talk about the role of prison as well as the Pullman strike, because Debs did not initially identify as a socialist. He began his organizing career in the Democratic Party. Is that correct?
Or kind of, sort of. Well, we can trace that if you want.
Yeah, please,
Before he was even part of the Democratic Party, Debs was also a trade union or craft union figure, first organizing locally and then nationally with the Brotherhood of Locomotive Firemen, which was a more conservative craft union just for white male locomotive firemen, one of a dozen similar craft unions. But basically, Gene could see that model of organizing, a narrow focus that mainly provided death benefits for its members, as opposed to extracting real concessions from employers, as only getting some fortunate workers so far. But also wanted to take that struggle to the political sphere, was easily elected as a Democrat 3 times before he was a radical figure, was liked by workers and their bosses, and served 2 terms as city clerk in Terre Haute, and then 1 term as a state rep in the Indiana General Assembly. It's... remarkable because we really don't see that much like reform-minded activity going on for Debs very early on as city clerk. Terre Haute had a thriving red light district as a transportation hub. Sex work was a big part of the economy, turns out, and Jean Debs, as city clerk, was responsible for collecting the fines assessed against the sex workers. Basically, as city clerk said, believed that it was immoral to punish the women for trying to make a living, while the men who bought the services saw no consequence under the law. So he just said, keep your money. I'm not worried about collecting it. And then got into the state house. He supported failed amendments to the state constitution that would have struck any distinction of race or sex from the state constitution. Those failed. And then introduced a bill that would have held railroads liable for deaths of workers, which seems so bare bones to us now. But keeping in mind that his union existed to pay for the members' funerals might have freed it up to do something more important than just cut checks for widows, but which was important to be clear. Anyway, the lower house in the state house did pass that liability bill, but the state senate took the teeth out so it couldn't be enforced if it passed using amendments. Gene was humiliated, withdrew the bill, and told his younger brother that he would never run for office again. So he spoke much too soon, but there's a pattern I see emerging here where Gene is going to try one track of fighting for change or organizing. He's only going to get so far, so he's going to have to redirect later down the road with something in many cases radically different than what he had embraced in the first part of his life.
I think it's, you talk about the pain for funeral expenses and the locomotive and fireman union, and I just think about like sometimes socialists get called idealists and we start from abstract ideas, and he's not. He's starting from like knowing the prostitutes in Terre Haute and knowing folks who lost loved ones on the railroad, and he's working up to the ideas from there. And I think it's a kind of fascinating model of thinking about change and even just conversion in his life.
Yeah, 100%. Something that I also find really relevant about the story is how dramatically Gene was able to embrace like change in his own worldview as well. Of course, we know that he became more radical as he aged, which is supposed to subvert the stereotype that you get more conservative as you age, which I don't know how true that really is at the end of the day. But it's not even just becoming more radical, but like taking dramatically different approaches to organizing, and in some cases, in many cases, going on a polar opposite track or belief or position than he might have held at earlier points in his life too. So not being afraid to like adjust his worldview based on new experiences and changing material reality, most importantly.
This is the biggest wall in the attic, and half of it is all spent on the Pullman strike. You don't see that much attention anywhere else in the murals to a single event, because this is the turning point for Debs. It's why he said he became a socialist. And it all kind of
that, I think that takes us to a good spot to talk about the Pullman strike.
This is May 11, 1894. They laid down their tools.
Which was, you know, you said there was, you know, an often, the trajectory of his life was constantly changing. But that felt like a pivotal moment for him in a strong shift in both in the experience of that strike and its failure, as well as prison. Talk about that. How did he emerge from that in a different, more radical place?
Definitely. So the Pullman strike, by the way, like, I know that this discussion is not going to be a whole blow-by-blow of what that entailed, but it was one of the biggest strikes in the history of this country. A quarter of a million railroad workers beyond the ranks of the union that Debs had been organizing participated in that strike, shutting down every major rail line from Detroit to California, and all to protest largely not their own conditions or pay or contracts, but to protest the living and working conditions for factory workers in Pullman, Illinois, that most of those strikers would have never encountered personally. There was a real, I think, meaningful show of solidarity in that strike, but it also showed Debs the extent to which employers and government can combine forces to halt worker organizing wherever it stands a meaningful chance of challenging power. And in the case of the Pullman strike, Gene was not oblivious to the fact that corporate power deeply, deeply affected political policy. And I think there's a really key point here in the Pullman strike. This is the summer of 94. The strike is underway. Every major line in the western half of the country is shut down. And it looked like a civil war could break out. I mean, I don't want to exaggerate or anything, but keeping in mind that the civil war was in living memory for Debs and his generation, it was not unthinkable to imagine this country coming apart at the seams over a major economic question. And Eventually, what happens is a federal court in Chicago issued an injunction written by river lawyers, to be clear, because that's how injunctions work, saying that the ARU, the American Railway Union, in the Pullman strike, was striking illegally because they were interfering with free trade across state lines. That was an application of the Sherman antitrust law, which, you know, was supposed to have been sold to us as benefiting average workers and breaking up monopolies. Well, Pullman was effectively a monopoly, so here you see it doing the opposite. Debs basically thought that the federal government had no right to call the outcome of a labor dispute, because if you call off a strike, you are ruling in favor of the employer. You can't pretend to be partial at that point. So Debs didn't call off the boycott. And it was the next day that Grover Cleveland, who in our murals here is pictured next to George Pullman, they have side-by-side portraits, Grover Cleveland, for whom Debs had campaigned as the pro-labor Democrat for president, Grover Cleveland ends up giving the green light to send in the United States Army to break the Pullman strike. And when I have to stop saying break the strike, it's a euphemism. It's shooting into crowds of strikers who refuse to clear the tracks. Dozens were shot and killed by our own army, hundreds arrested, thousands blacklisted, and Debs and all the ARU officers, this brand new type of more solid juristic union that could encompass workers of all different parts of an industry into one strong organization that stands a chance of challenging power, and all of its officers end up in jail. It's not that Debs emerged from jail a socialist. I want to be clear. There's a lot kind of made out of the overnight conversion, which is not really what happened. I mean, Gene had also been exposed to socialist ideas throughout his life and had dismissed them openly. He thought that you didn't need a revolution, that even under capitalism, you're not going to have equality, of course, but you could have something livable for everybody if we have strong unions and a responsive democracy to curb the excess of capital. The Pullman strike is kind of what dashed Debs' hopes in many ways. And like, to be clear, Debs did spend a brief time in Cook County Jail and was horrified by the conditions that he saw. He described rats the size of small dogs, or maybe cats or something like that. But he also was floored by the humanity that he witnessed of his fellow prisoners in the Cook County Jail. Men cutting cigars into 3-4 pieces so they could share with as many other smokers as possible. Like people who had nothing, being willing to share the few things that they did have.
And you shared that this led to a lifelong view of abolition for him, an end to the jail system.
Definitely. I mean, he was talking about abolition like explicitly as early as 1899, I can tell so far. He gave a long lecture called Prison Labor at Delmonico's Steakhouse in New York. So he's talking to the moneyed elite of the city, and like he was asked to come talk about prison labor and how it has a demoralizing effect on the economy. And Gene comes in to say, actually, this economy has a demoralizing effect on all of our labor, right? Yeah. Yep. He's saying that prison labor is bad, but not just because it drives down wages for labor outside of prisons, which was the argument at the time, that it forces workers outside of prisons to compete with those making nothing, and drives down wages across the board. Gene says, as true or false as that might be, like, it doesn't matter as long as all of us are toiling under a privately owned system. None of us are truly free. None of our labor is truly free, whether it's completed inside or outside of an institution. So, and then he says that you will not solve the prison question or the prison labor question without solving the capitalism question and restructuring our economy to collective ownership for use and need instead of profit. I mean, it's all right there. And says that the prison could cease to exist as we understand it. And later on wrote a whole book about these ideas. It's called Walls and Bars. It was published after Debs' death. And it's all about his own firsthand experiences. Debs gave a really sophisticated political and economic analysis of the prison as an institution for the poor, a rule to which he wrote there are very few exceptions, and then outlined the abolitionist argument. He wrote, this is verbatim, that socialism should abolish the prison by eliminating its cause. So there's a million angles you could take at that, but he's saying, like, address the social and economic causes of crime caused by capitalism before it happens by abolishing capitalism instead of punishing crime individually after the fact in a way that, like Debs also argued, drives so much more crime in the long run. Also, never forgetting the issue of prison labor and the fact that, and we know, the 13th Amendment, there's the asterisk on slavery, like, we don't have it unless you've been convicted of a crime, which I know your listeners know means that you create a demand for criminals in the form of free labor. You're going to criminalize people to fill those roles at the end of the day. You're going to have a permanent underclass to draw that from, too. So I don't have to convince you of your listeners of this, I think. But just the fact that Debs was writing about this stuff 100 years ago, and I'm also really heartened to see so much interest in this today, especially with social movements, protest movements of the last 4 or 5 years, really digging into some of the same questions, fundamental questions about who our system is set up to benefit and what prisons actually do, what police do too.
Every church I've been in, I've had folks who have family members who are in prison, and it doesn't matter where they are at on the political spectrum. If they have a family member in prison, they think prisons are awful. And I think that's true with, it sounds like with Debs, where he gets into prison and realizes that, oh, this is dehumanizing, this is bad. And it's part of the reason today why they, when they build prisons, they're not in the center of your downtown city. They're out in some small community that nobody's ever going to go see, because if you saw what went on there, you'd be like Debs. You'd become an abolitionist for prisons.
Yeah, I think there's a lot I want to tie that to Terre Haute with as well. Terre Haute is the site of a federal correctional complex, which also includes federal death row. So all the executions that take place under any Department of Justice that wants to move forward with pursuing executions happen here in Terre Haute, about 3 miles south of the house. But that prison was hailed in Terre Haute back in the 40s because of the jobs it was going to bring, too. So it's, again, a contradiction that I don't think you can resolve under this existing system either.
Debs say no way in hell are you marrying a worker, let alone a Catholic girl. So they leave. They get to Brooklyn about a year apart, where they married and never looked back. Did not have...
As you quote from Debs very impressively, I might add, you know, I feel like I'm in church a little bit. Keep kind of amening as we go. So let's move to that. Let's talk about Debs not just as a political figure, but as a spiritual one, a person of deep faith. Tell us about his family background, which is really interesting, and I can totally draw the thread from his parents and their faith experience to him and his own. Tell us about the role of faith in developing Debs.
It cannot be understated. So I do want to take it back to his parents, who part of the reason that they immigrated from France was so they could marry across religious divides. And it wasn't just that. There was a class picture here, too. But basically, she, Jean's future mother, Daisy Debs, was a working-class Catholic employee of the Debs' family in Colmar, Alsace, France. And the Debs' say, you're not marrying a worker, let alone a Catholic girl. So they got to Brooklyn about a year apart, where Daniel and Daisy Debs marry and never look back, is what I say. Did not have a lot of nice things to say about the Debs' who stayed behind in France, too. Now, the Debs' did not raise their children in, like, a strict religious upbringing, I guess. Jean, I believe, don't quote me necessarily on this, but I'm pretty sure, was the first of the children to not be baptized. So there's, you know, something going on there too. His mother did continue to attend Catholic services and take Mass in Terre Haute. His father was not a regular churchgoer and did, like, allow the children to be exposed to different, like, stripes of Protestant religions or Protestantism, I guess, as well. But Jean was really, as a boy, turned off by the hellfire preaching that he saw in town, too. And kind of just got, I think, a sour taste in his mouth around organized religion. And I think it's best to describe his upbringing as, like, a humanistic freethinker, if that makes sense. He never calls himself, as far as I can tell, an atheist or an agnostic, but he also doesn't really refer to himself as a Christian either. Now, he did not shut up about Christ as the proletaire of Galilee, and a pure communist too, especially later in life. Like, Jean really dug into the religious symbolism, but thought that Christianity, he described socialism in interviews as merely Christianity in action. And that's when, like, the more orthodox socialists next to him are going to elbow him a little bit and say, come on, Jean, there's a little more to it than that. But the idea is, do unto others, don't exploit thy neighbor at the end of the day. If you don't want it to happen to your own family, then why would you do it to the families of the people around you and in your communities as well? There's so much to this, but Jean also was very, very critical of how he saw organized religion as keeping the working class in its place, not challenging the status quo. I'm always reminded of the IWW singer Joe Hill and his song Pie in the Sky. He's kind of riffing on some of, like, the Salvation Army hymns and basically saying that they tell you you'll get pie in the sky when you die, but that's the lie. You have to fight for a better world here and now and not just wait for something waiting for us after your death. Like, fight for it now, right? Right. So
it's the first half of Marx's Opiate of the Mass, right? It's the perennial trouble with the comfort of spirituality that it can lull. or it can excite or energize.
When, do you all know the G.K. Chesterton quote from like the same time period about it's not that Christianity's been tried and not wanted, but it has been wanted and not tried? I mean, it makes me think of that. Like if you actually did the gospel, look a little bit different than some of our organized churches.
So Debs, you know, has kind of a socialist change politically. How does that interact with his faith? He becomes part of a network of Christian socialism and that sort of stuff. Could you describe maybe the 20th century scene of Christian socialism?
You talked about how, with Dorothy Day talking about like fighting for a world that makes it easier for us to be good to each other, the Christian socialists were, I mean, she's one of those, of course, but basically saying let's use socialism or socialist ideas to build a world that enables us to actually be Christians and to practice what we preach here. That we're going to build a world around cooperation and mutuality instead of competition at the end of the day, which I don't see as like terribly Christian at the end of the day. If you have competition, somebody's going to lose. And that's one thing when it comes to a race or a game, but that's a totally different thing when it comes to our economy and our livelihoods. So the Christian socialists, they're all over the place. One of them, though, that stands out to me would be George Herron, who started one of those cooperative farms out in the Northeast somewhere, and I don't think it lasted for very long, but he went on to co-found the Rand School of Social Sciences in New York. We have a plaque from in the hallway downstairs, which was a socialist college, integrated and co-ed, meant to turn out more radical working class leaders like Gene Debs. Now, I don't know that the Rand School itself was like an explicitly Christian institution. I mean, probably multi-faith more than anything, but the project of a Christian socialist too. I don't think you can separate Debs at all from the Christian socialist, even if he wasn't using the term Christian like to describe himself. And especially heading into the turn of the century, the socialists who convinced Debs of the merits of socialism were largely Christians, as far as I can tell, too. So, like, I don't always immediately associate Edward Bellamy with the Christian socialist, but I guess he was one of those. And it was looking backward that Debs, the
apparently
novel...
Apparently one of the most famous American books that I've never heard of.
That's just it. We could do a whole episode on that one, honestly. So, Looking Backward by Edward Bellamy, one of the most commercially successful novels in the history of this country, was the third best-selling book of the 19th century, behind Ben-Hur and Uncle Tom's Cabin. So why don't we know about this book? It was all about a robber baron who falls asleep during a strike in Boston in the 1880s and wakes up in the year 2000, and boom, it's socialism. And the whole rest of the book is his hosts in Boston in the year 2000 telling all the stories about how they came to be where they are, what a cooperative economy looked like based around need and use instead of profit. They're predicting technological advances and inventions that are going to be around like decades into the future, but things like radio and debit cards. And it was so popular that readers formed what they called Bellamy clubs or nationalist clubs all over the country. And the nationalist in the sense of nationalizing industry for cooperative administration, not nationalism like my country is the best or whatever. But anyway, these nationalist clubs or Bellamy clubs sprung up all over the country. And one of Gene's first running mates, actually his first running mate in 1900, Job Harriman, became a socialist because of the nationalist movement and the nationalist club and Bellamy movement too. Like because of the ideas that came out of this novel, Looking Backward, which was actually a novelization of Lawrence Gronlund's Cooperative Commonwealth, which was a more pure economic text. It wasn't necessarily Marxist, but written around cooperative use, cooperative administration of industry for use and need instead of profit. The ideas that Deb said helped set the wires humming in a system. He loved reading Bellamy. And then the Red Scare means that so much of this literature is struck from the syllabus in public schools.
1,000 people greeted him at the train station as a homecoming celebration. And if that number is true, by the way, Tara, what is 60,000 then and now? I hope it gives you a sense of the scale of how embraced Debs was, not just by local socialists and union members, but by a community that actually did find a lot of ways to embrace Debs' character and integrity.
It's interesting seeing some of these threads of Debs' life. Yes, with his parents and the experience of being in two kind of very different worlds and wanting to make that work and it not being okay. And then showing up in all of these various different political spaces, working with the city, working with government officials, but also with the workers and unions. And you describe in the tour, you described this moment of him coming back home to Terre Haute. Was this after prison? And 50,000 people showing up at the train station in a town of 60,000 people, many of whom did not vote for him as president. And yet there was this affection for him across all of these different political spaces. And my question hits very, very home for me, because I think the left is a relationally difficult place. And I think we struggle to find ways to connect with the people who are so ideologically close to us, are often our worst enemies. What Debs feels so different in that. How is that so? What might we learn from Debs?
I think that's a really important point, because it's about the hand clasp of a comrade. Like, I'm not going to be able to quote exactly, but there's so many like passages from some of Gene's speeches that are coming to mind right now that, I mean, he said that the socialist movement had given him his ideas and his ideals and enabled him to be part of something bigger than himself. And I don't think it was just the socialist movement at the end of the day. It's also like the labor movement and any struggle for democracy and what's right in any of our systems. But that it, he said, enabled him to like hold high communion with his fellow workers at the end of the day. Like, that's actually part of the quote there too, that I think Gene understood that there's so much more that unites us than divides us, that we have so much more in common than different. And when we can really figure it out, we can't be stopped. It's amazing, the scathing letters that you can read from Debs, between Debs and other socialists or unionists, disagreeing like to no end, basically, about some of their tactics and strategies and ideologies. But it's always opening with this warm, loving, like, I am so glad to have received your letter of November 7th or whatever. And I read it with such eager eyes and heart, and I have never received a better letter in my life. And then he'll just eviscerate you or whatever, and then close with a little bit more of the same, saying, but anyway, I still love you, and we're still going to be okay. And like, I feel nothing but Carmelite brotherhood to you or whatever else. That at the end of the day, he understood that it's the relationships are what makes this movement go, more than any disagreement or agreement over specific tactics or strategies, that what we have that unites us is what makes us strong. So
you can feel that he loves humanity. And I think sometimes that's what feels missing, is that he actually has a hope that in the end, you are a sibling, you are a comrade, you are someone with inherent worth. You get back to the abolition piece here as well, that you have, as a human, you have inherent worth. And I'm going to fight for that, whether you are on the same political aisle as me or not. And I'm actually going to treat you as a human, because I have hope for you and for us. And maybe it's just a lack of hope that I experience on the left, but it's really refreshing to experience this ideology in a package that feels warm and genuine and so relational.
Yeah, and to your point about the optimism, like, that is it's like solidarity and optimism, basically, is like two words that can really help wrap your head around Debs, basically. And it wasn't this like Pollyannish, like, oh, everything's going to be okay, we don't have to worry about it. But that he really, like you're saying, he really did believe in people. I think that's a good reason to describe him as a humanist as well. He believed in human potential and human capacity, and he had seen the extremes like throughout the course of his life. And I always want to remember that the Civil War was in living memory. Like, he was old enough to remember Union soldiers coming back to Terre Haute wounded and dead at the end of the Civil War as well. I guess, like, the title of one of his biographies, the classic biography by Ray Ginger, is called The Bending Cross, and that is a reference to a quote we talked about in your tour from Gene's sentencing hearing statement. He'd been convicted of sedition, was waiting on his sentence, and he gives a long, flowery speech and then closes with some symbolism. He's talking about a sailor navigating by the night sky, using constellations to guide the way, who would turn his eyes to the Southern Cross, a constellation of stars burning luridly over the tempest-vexed sea. And when the cross of stars begins to bend in its shape, that's how a mariner can know that midnight has passed, dawn is on its way, relief and rest are close at hand. And Deb says, let the people everywhere take heart and hope, for the cross is bending. The midnight is passing, and joy cometh with the morning. You know, Your Honor, I'm prepared to receive your sentence. And that's where it really kicks you in the gut, because the judge gave Debs 10 years, and Debs would not live 10 years. So he's staking it all, like this whole trial and this whole part of his life, on the idea of democracy. And it's, you see how it's paying him back with a 10-year sentence, and it looks like Debs will die in a cell. Ended up serving just 3 years of the 10 years, but this is where Gene really did have to fall back on some of those spiritual beliefs too. He was able to, I think, find some comfort and solace in the idea of like a Christ figure too. And it's part of what sustained him in some of the darkest moments of his life. So there's so much to this.
So his prison sentence was sedition, the one that he was actually convicted of. And this comes because of his protest of the war. And it's, or can you say more about that? Because there's, there's more to it than just being against this, the First World War.
Right, right. Yeah, it's about being the whole, against the entire order that created the conditions that led to the rise of the Great War. Yeah. So Debs had given what was at the time an illegal speech in Canton, Ohio. On the tour, I usually back up and give a lot of background around World War One, the draft, this unpopular war effort, not just unpopular with socialists, but R's and D's too. And the fact that the Wilson administration signed the sedition and espionage laws, meaning that if you criticize the war effort or the U.S. government, you can be stripped of your citizenship if you're an immigrant, shipped out to a country you might not even remember. People like Debs faced prison sentences of 10 to 20 years, and like newspapers were shut down for publishing anti-war articles. So really flying in the face of what we're supposed to consider our strong free speech tradition in this country. And even some socialists would buck the party's anti-war stance, which the party remarkably did take an anti-war position, which there's a lot to be said, I think, about why that is as remarkable as it was, considering what's going on with the German socialists around the same time, who did vote for war credits. And there's a whole lot there, right?
Yeah.
But basically, Debs in Canton, Ohio, gave this two-hour speech about the idea of democracy and why our institutions are not reflecting that. And basically saying, if war is ever really right, let it be declared by the people. You who have your lives to lose above all others should decide the momentous issues of war or peace. He supported a Georgist amendment to the state to the U.S. Constitution that would put any declaration of war to a popular vote, and those voting in favor would be volunteering by voting in favor. So, like, you know, imagine how quickly wars could end if we did that. But it was all. He also expressed his enthusiasm for the Bolshevik Revolution. Calls himself a Bolshevik from the crown of his head to the soles of his feet. I think I would have been electrified right there with him at the time if I had been in his shoes. But this is all enough to lock him up, and not specifically on the Russia thing, but just on criticism the war effort. He was indicted by a federal grand jury in Cleveland on 10 counts of sedition, meaning inciting rebellion. And to be clear, like, the sedition law was an amendment to the espionage law. Both of them like coming together to criminalize dissent around the war in particular, saying that you're aiding the enemy, basically. So you can say it was a sedition conviction or an espionage conviction, like whatever you want to use. It's all the same, like in this case, the same thing.
How you're talking now, it reminds me of Andrew's question about the Constitution. So maybe you could ask about that.
Yeah, I was just asking, there's debate in DSA particular right now about our relationship to America as an idea and the Constitution in particular, and whether or not you can hold ideas of America apart from, say, the political governmental structures that maybe are unjust. And I think I boiled it down to asking just was Eugene Debs a patriot?
And did he have an opinion about the Constitution?
Yeah.
Yeah, two really important questions that Gene would dramatically change on over the course of his life. We talked about on your tour how, like, early in life he was a flag waver and like thought that this was the greatest country in the world. But yeah.
There's a picture of him on the wall here, you know, backed by this great, you know, American bunting as he's giving a speech.
Actually, it's funny that the artist did this, because this is around the same era that Deb starts to say things like he would never worship a flag that he thought stood for slavery. And he thought that the American flag was synonymous with slavery as an institution.
Interesting.
Like, he said that, like, word for word. And then to the point about the Constitution, again, changed dramatically over the course of his life, thought that it was practically divinely inspired earlier in life, but later in life decided that it was irrelevant and had outlived its usefulness. He also thought that it was written and shaped by slavers, by exploiters, and thought that women, people of color, the working class had never had their views taken into consideration when those documents were being formed. He did think that the Declaration of Independence was a radical document and that it was that his radicalism was usurped by the Constitution, and was campaigning when he ran for president on calling a constitutional convention to let the working class, through a real democracy, decide to what extent the Constitution is really the most effective founding document for our system now too. So lots to it, but he had a lot of his own personal views, but thought that it should be left up to an emancipated, liberated working class.
I really appreciate that answer. I think I started the question during the tour as, this is something I have conflict around a lot, and your answer helped me work that out a little bit in my head. So.
Dang, him too.
Yeah.
Glad to hear.
Yeah.
As French immigrants, the Debs who raised their kids on a healthy diet of Victor Hugo and Voltaire. Eugene V. Debs, the V is for Victor.
Could you talk a little bit about who was an important figure? Obviously, there are so many people shaping his later kind of socialist perspectives, who he's reading in prison and who he's interacting with on an international scale. But could you also talk about who were some of those earlier figures shaping him and to make who Debs is?
Yeah, for sure. And just as a little background, his father had studied literature before he immigrated from France. And here in the murals next to the parents, there are like three sepia-toned portraits of writers and figures, like right by the parents, like to kind of show that this is the ethos that Gene is raised in, the names read in his house. And it was a very literary house, so lots of music and poetry as well. But the three faces on the wall there are Victor Hugo, Voltaire, and Thomas Paine. So starting with Victor Hugo, who Gene is named after, the Eugene V. Debs, the V stands for Victor. He's named for Victor Hugo, so his dad knew what he was doing there. Victor Hugo, we know for Les Miserables and The Hunchback of Notre Dame, all about the outcasts, the discarded, the miserables, of course. And Gene said he read it over and over in French, Les Mis, I mean, as a boy in French. And I'm still working on the English audiobook, so I don't know how he did it. But if you know the story of Jean Valjean, who steals bread and goes to prison for 19 years, and that's just the exposition of the novel, Gene's favorite book, not hard to see how Convict 24601 might go on to shape Convict 9653. Thank you very much. Anyway,
nice.
And then the next face up there was Voltaire. So definitely Gene being raised in like the ideas of like the Enlightenment or whatever you want. Liberty, brotherhood, equality is the foundation for Gene and his worldview. And the third face up there being Thomas Paine. Who, you know, if you've got to pick an American revolutionary, he's going to be my favorite because, first and foremost, he didn't believe in owning and selling human beings, but was actually a radical.
Low bar, but yes.
Yeah, low bar for sure. But was actually like a real revolutionary in so many ways and wrote about basic income for young people. The newspaper that Debs edited later down the road, The Appeal to Reason up here, the title is a reference to Thomas Paine's writings as well. And kind of my spiel about this on the tour is that a lot of ink has been spilled over how much Debs is shaped by Paine, Lincoln, Jefferson, Washington, Patrick Henry. Some biographers insist more than Marx and Engels, and I think there's something to that, but I also think it's all of the above, and I'm not afraid to say that. I think it just shows how remarkable Debs was that he could take those European, later in life, economic and social ideas and help them make sense to his audiences in the American lowercase d so-called democratic tradition where you don't have kings and queens, but look at the landed aristocracy that none of us got to vote for, have a say in who calls the shots in our economy and our workplaces every single day. What's more American, if you want, and I don't think it's uniquely American, to fight for a say, not just at the ballot box every 2 or 4 years, but every single day in our workplaces, in our industries.
And I think what you're saying there, too, about interpreting the ideas for the American context is something that is needed today. And I just think it's in an era when we need somebody like him. What do you think it means to reignite his legacy? How do we do that? How does he become a figure that we look to? We don't have to look to Germany or Russia or France. You can look to
right in the cornfields of Indiana.
Yeah, and find inspiration.
Gosh, well, I think it really goes to connecting the dots. And like I can yap on and on here at the house doing my tours as much as I want, but that's only going to reach so many people who come through the door here. I think it's really about connecting the dots and showing what it would mean to see something like the Pullman strike or the Socialist Party or whatever fighting for some of the same things today. And like, they're not going to be the exact same institutions. The circumstances, the material reality has changed a lot as well. But if we can show like what a sympathy strike looks like, which is like something that's been totally stamped out, I feel like, of our collective imagination or memory, like what it means to walk off the job for something besides your own immediate fight. Like those are illegal strikes today.
An unimaginable show of solidarity. Yeah. We really don't have an imagination for something like that.
Right, right. And I mean, there's a lot of reasons for that too. Like our labor law is, I would argue, and this is a hot topic, but like set up to discourage major disruptive actions like that. It's part of like why we got the compromise of the New Deal that we did, was because these labor actions really, really were disruptive and they did shut systems down. But now it is illegal to go on strike for anything beyond your own immediate contract with a few very, very rare exceptions. But I think it means connecting the dots here and showing that like we have so much more potential beyond just maybe what is stipulated in a specific contract or in a specific set of laws. And I know like you can't like urge people to break the law on this podcast or whatever. I don't know, maybe you can.
Hey, you do what you want.
If it was good enough for Jesus, it's good enough for us.
There you go.
Yeah. There we go. I'll take it. But also showing like that these conditions or these struggles are not said and done. This is not over. We talk about having protections for organizing today, but making the case, like the irrefutable case, that people are still fired every day for trying to organize their workplaces. Something that, like, so bare bones, we're supposed to have accepted and move on from. Like, you have the right to organize, don't worry about it. But we really do not in practice. It's a miracle that workers are able to form any kind of new union today where it does happen. But showing that you have maybe more in common with an industrial worker like an engineer or a fireman or a factory worker 100 years ago, you have more in common with them than you might think as a fast food worker, as a retail worker in education or healthcare too. That there's so much more that unites us across time and across our industries than divides us. And when we can figure it out, once again, we cannot be stopped.
So lastly, I want to encourage people to visit the Devs Museum here in Terre Haute. So give us some more info about upcoming events you have, happenings here, and then also where would you point them for further reading and study on Eugene Debs?
Definitely. So come visit the Debs House. This is a free museum. Right now we are open 5 days a week, 12 to 5, Tuesday through Saturday, and we're probably going to change our hours soon as we're working on some building stuff right now. So just check our website. But it's in Terre Haute, Indiana, on the campus of Indiana State University. We're an independent nonprofit, but it's conveniently located near downtown and right on campus. And our tours are 30 to 90 minutes, depending on what you're after. You can honestly stay for several hours if you want to. That's always fun as well. But you see the entire house. It takes you through the life story of Gene, puts so much context around him, and then also connects him to the present day, which is like at the core of what I'm trying to do here with this house. We are at debsfoundation.org. We have a gift shop where you can shop for all kinds of Debs swag, posters, t-shirts, books. Everything that we order is union made and printed. Keep an eye out for Debs Day in June, our annual award program in the fall. We also have film screenings, lectures, and smaller programs at the house all year long too. So we'd love to see some faces here for those as well. Watch our social media. I also do free Zoom tours and presentations, lectures. So if you have a group or a family or even just you listening, want to see the house but won't get out to Terre Haute, just email or call us or DM us on Twitter and we'll set up a Zoom tour.
This is a great DSA chapter idea. So yes, yeah, do that.
Had some really fun Zoom tours for Chicago DSA and Columbus DSA and Central Indiana. So we'd love to have your DSA chapter or your union local or your working group take a group tour. It's always a blast.
Amazing. So let's close with some words from Debs. Do you mind?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a quote on the wall here from Debs' sentencing hearing statement. Upon his conviction of violating the Sedition Act, and Debs opened that statement to the court by saying, "Your Honor, years ago, I recognized my kinship with all living beings and made up my mind that I was not one bit better than the meanest on earth. I said then, and I say now, that while there is a lower class, I am in it. While there is a criminal element, I am of it. And while there is a soul in prison, I am not free."
Amen. Amazing. Allison, thank you so much for joining. It's been a pleasure, and I will be sharing the Debs Museum with anyone, especially those in Indiana. It's close enough. You need to come.
Thank you both. This has been such a wonderful discussion. I've had such a fun time.
This has been an episode of Heart of a Heartless World. Get connected and learn more by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, or check out our website, religioussocialism.org.
Good soundbite for the podcast.